the head of the Department of Conservation on its large and ageing assets and the tough decisions that need to be made on what to replace and what to maintain. DOC administers New Zealand's largest recreation network, including more than 14,000 kilometres of tracks, 326 campsites, approximately 950 backcountry huts, and numerous heritage sites across one-third of the country. Recent extreme weather events have caused extensive damage to infrastructure, and the budget earlier this month allocated $12.6 million to DOC to plan and to rebuild biodiversity, heritage, visitor and other conservation sites damaged in the weather. Last year's budget provided DOC with new funding of $60 million over 4 years for visitor asset management. But documents released under the Official Information Act recently show the department has dozens of high-risk structures overdue for maintenance, and a backlog of maintenance on its huts and tracks network worth over $300 million. Penny Nelson, good morning. Welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about conservation.
Can we begin with a story just in the news this morning, actually, reporting on RNZ, which is what is happening with the bookings for the Great Walks. First, it was May that they were scheduled to be released, then the system crashed, then it was to be June, now that's been delayed again. Why?
So we work with an international provider. There was a glitch this year as we went live. So what we've been doing is we've found the problem. Our provider has tested it and are telling us that it's working. Our own people have tested it and tell us that it's working. But because it really matters to New Zealanders for us to get it right, we're having a totally independent person testing it. We expect to have that back mid-June and then we'll go live. So we're taking a belts and braces approach because we don't want to let New Zealanders down again.
So mid-June will now be the date for opening up. I think Milford happened the Milford track happened in May.
So once we get the results back from the independent testing, yeah, we will then make a decision about when we open things for bookings, and we will update you on that around mid-June.
So mid-June will be an update. It might not necessarily be the date that the bookings open.
So that will depend on how the independent testing goes. But I think given it's the third time we're looking at it, I'm hopeful that we will be off. But okay, what matters to me is New Zealanders love their Great Walks. We don't want to be letting them down again, so we're taking a belts and braces approach to getting it right.
Is this a new provider? Or
no, it's the same provider that we've used over many years, but there was a change they made on something ahead of us opening this year, which has caused the problem.
Okay. So at the moment, mid-June for an update. If all's well, possibly a new date shortly after that, but possibly not till July, you're hoping mid-June-ish.
We'll give you an update as soon as we've had that independent testing done.
Okay. Were any tickets or any places sold actually in that opening ballot? Are there some people who have secured spots, or are we right back to square one? What was the status before things crashed?
So I think what I'm really keen to focus on today is not the sort of detail of all of that. Our team can update people on that. What I'm really keen to focus on is what you talked about in your introduction. So that the scale of what we have got to do with the visitor network is enormous. What I've found in the last 18 months, Catherine, is we've also got a huge job to do across biodiversity with 4,000 species who are in trouble. We've got a big regulatory function, and we've also got one of the biggest functions in government to deliver on our treaty settlements. So we've got about 3,000 things that we have to do there. So what I'm focused on is how do we ensure we've got the best visitor network for New Zealanders, and then what do we need to do to deal with the crisis that we've got for nature.
You're 18 months into the job. What do you make of the challenges outlined in those documents?
So I think the thing that has really opened my eyes over the last 18 months is I've worked in the government system for a long time. I didn't realise how big the scale of what DOC is being asked to do was. It is enormous. We are responsible for managing a third of the country, and when you've got about $25 per hectare to do that, that's challenging. We're always having to make trade-offs on what we we do and have to think about what's going to be the impact for people's visitor experience versus what are we actually doing to save nature. And when we've got 4,000 species in trouble and we are able to manage about 116 well, that there's a bit of a gap. So
that's not new information, though. I mean, Forest and Bird and the likes have put out annual reports on that for years. So I guess what I'm asking is, how bad do the books look, so to speak? And I'm not just talking finances. When you came in and got the same official advice released to the minister that we've been reading, was that news to you?
So a lot of the information that you've talked about was information I got as I came in 18 months ago. So there's a lot that we've done since then. So, for example, that $60 million that we've got to invest in maintenance came off the back of making a case from some of that information that came through. What we've also done is we've got a much better system for providing information on our assets. So that we've rolled out a new system. It'll enable us to have good information and plan for the future. We've also put in a really good group around us with engineers, infrastructure experts, to help us work through how we work through those
okay.
issues.
Let's start with the safety stuff. Given a dreadful moment in DOC's history, let's start with the safety stuff. I appreciate some of these numbers will have changed, but we were looking at something like 99 high priority safety critical work orders on some assets. There was that figure actually of overdue work jobs to be done on critical safety high risk structures. Here we go. Work orders, as in August last year, 68 high risk structures were overdue. Where are we at in that, what seems to be high priority management of high risk structures?
So safety will always be a number one priority for us, particularly given what we've had with things like Cave Creek and helicopter crashes. So where we're at is we don't have any outstanding high priority maintenance. What we've got is about 1,500 outstanding orders, and when you've got 58,000 assets, that's pretty reasonable. And the ones that are outstanding are around, you know, we haven't got the right mattresses, etc. So
those dozens of work orders for high-risk structures being overdue, as high as 68 in August, what is their status?
So the outstanding ones go into, you know, we either, if there's a problem, we close things, and you'll have seen that we did that with a few structures last week, and then we work our way through them. So I think we're in a much better position than we were.
Well, has that number come down? Because I appreciate you close them, but then they're unavailable to the public. And, you know, we could get to the point where more and more and more is closed. Are you making inroads into actually doing the maintenance on those structures?
So, yes, we're making inroads to the maintenance. And I think the really critical thing that we need to look at is, over the last 20 years, DOC has, in an ad hoc way, accumulated a whole lot of visitor assets. Sometimes those things have come without the money to maintain them. So what we want to work through is, what are the assets that we need for a really good visitor network into the future? And we're starting to do that with the work off the back of the cyclone recovery. So through that, we've had 550 sites that have been damaged. What we've done is we've taken one of our really good regional ops directors offline to work with a team across DOC to look at what we do. And where we're getting to is, there's about 50% of that damage that we're just going to get on and fix. There's another bucket of things where we're just getting geotechnical advice, and then we'll work out what we need to put in place to defend it. So, for example, Cathedral Cove, so that we can get that open by the summer. And then there's a grouping of things where we're going to have to make calls about, do we put them back or not? And when you put the climate change lens over that, some of it doesn't make sense, okay, because they'll just be washed out in the next storm.
So the 550 sites are actually new. They're on top of what we were talking about from the Official Information Act documents, which, by the way, included DOC being 70,000 hours behind on scheduled maintenance. And actually, before we get to the storm stuff, can you just explain that? Why is it so far behind on scheduled maintenance? What's the missing resource or opportunity?
So in terms of the decisions we make around maintenance, we will always focus on the high-risk things that matter for people's safety first, and then there are other things to do with maintenance that we might not get to. So, for example, we may not do some of the track maintenance that we need to do so that it's at, you know, a brilliant standard. The reason that there are sometimes things that are left to do is because in terms of the operating budget that we've got, given the scale of everything we've got to do, every day we have to make choices about do we put that operating money into, maintaining a hut, a track, or do we put it into saving a species? We always have to make those trade-offs.
But what happens then that scheduled maintenance gets further and further behind and more things get closed? So before we come to the storm damage, and I appreciate that's a new challenge, can we reflect on the interview we had recently with one of the volunteer groups that does work on those backcountry huts and those backcountry tracks to the tune of millions of dollars, hundreds of volunteers, and has made that work happen? I'm talking about the Backcountry Trust. Over 10 years, 280 huts it's worked on, 1,500 kilometres of track involving 900 volunteers. Is that the way to deal with what might on a piece of paper look like a lower priority, but actually many people would believe is kind of at the heart of what DOC's role is, which is not being the tourism department for international visitors on the Great Walks, but maintaining and making possible a backcountry experience for New Zealanders in their own country? Where are you at with working with volunteers to try and keep up on that work? Because they weren't speaking very positively about how that relationship is evolving.
So the Backcountry Trust does absolutely incredible work, and I'm really grateful for the volunteers that work with them. We meet with the Backcountry Trust regularly, and what we work on is in terms of all of the work that we have to do, where does it make most sense for them to do what they do? So I think they're a really important part of the puzzle, but they're not the whole deal. In terms of some of those challenges we've got, Catherine, one of the reasons that we are doing a baseline review to ourselves as a department is because the scale of what we're being asked to do in terms of our statutory responsibilities are enormous, given the budget that we've got. And so what we're doing is we're working through for everything we're being asked to do and the budget that we've got, what can we do? If we were actually going to be able to fill all of those functions well, what would that cost? And then have some, middle options. And in my experience, ministers make the best decisions when they've got really good evidence of what the trade-offs and the risks are. So that's what we're working on at the moment.
Okay, so you're making a presentation for more money, which in the current circumstances may or may not be successful. But DOC has looked sometimes with criticism in recent years about ways of doing things differently, whether it is partnerships with commercial operators, whether it is partnerships with volunteers. There's long been an acknowledgement that there's never going to be enough money. And when one of those significant volunteer groups says it is harder to talk to people and indeed suggests that that the regional staff they deal with find it harder to talk to people at head office, is that not a place to have an immediate impact?
So I've had a meeting with the Backcountry Trust yesterday, and that was not the message I was getting. The message that I was getting from the Backcountry Trust is the results that they're getting, that they are currently meeting with all of our regional operations directors on the ground about where they might fit into work programs in the coming year. And then they're also really interested in working with us at that strategic level on the work that we're doing at the moment around what does our future visitor asset need to look like.
Are those regional offices sufficiently staffed? And actually, the figure was given, and I'd like you to either correct or confirm it, that DOC's hired another 800 staff since 2017. Is that an accurate figure?
So, as I mentioned to you before, for the scale of what we've got to do, that the resourcing doesn't match it, and we always have to make choices. So the reason that we're doing the work that we're doing is so that there's much better information for ministers and for New Zealanders about what the choices are.
But is that the ballpark figure for added headcount since 2017?
So I don't have that detail at my fingertips.
Fine. Understood.
But, yep.
Because the other issue is whether we have quite a lot of people sitting in offices in Wellington relative to the number of people hands-on doing work, building relationships, goodness knows, getting sign-off to mend huts, tracks, do simple things in their own districts. As part of this baseline review you're doing, are you looking at where staff are and where that resource is being based?
So, absolutely. So we are one organisation. We can always move things around. So we have people on the ground who do incredible work, and we also have people doing really important jobs who aren't out in the field. So, for example, you know, our biodiversity scientists, our people who are delivering on our treaty settlements, our people who do all of our concessions. That's huge. If we don't get that right, it has a major economic impact. So I think, you know, every role in DOC is important. And as we do this work, what we've got to work through is what's the right balance of where we have people. And we need to keep amending that over time so that we get the biggest impact we can.
All right. Let's come back to the storm impact. $12.6 million in this year's budget to plan and rebuild biodiversity heritage visitor and other conservation sites damaged in the weather. You've said 550 sites impacted. Perhaps half you'll automatically go ahead and do the repair work. Others, it's geotech to see how bad it is, and there are calls to be made about what to do. What kinds of sites? You mentioned Cathedral Coves, much beloved. What other sites are in that 550?
So what we've got is that there's a you know, so there's huts, roads, you know, a number of other structures and tracks. And I think the thing that I think we've got a huge opportunity to look at is climate change adaptation. So, you know, as you've seen over the last 18 months, we've had a lot of those storms. We haven't hard baked looking at climate change into all of our decisions in the past. So what this gives us an opportunity to do is think quite differently about that. And what I want to assure people is, as we do that, we'll be working with concessionaires and iwi and others to work out, you know, what those opportunities are to do things
public,
differently.
How public is this going to be? Are there going to be a few Cathedral Coves? Are there going to be a few really highly treasured, and again, some of them may be backcountry, it might be in, I don't know, Aoraki, Mount Cook National Park or wherever, that are not necessarily high tourism sites, but are regarded as taonga. Are there going to be some pretty big sites potentially under review for not restoring?
So that's the work that we're doing at the moment, and I can't talk to you about it until we've done it.
Will it but be what public I can as part of a decision-making process?
So one of the things I love about this job is New Zealanders really care about the visitor network that we've got, and they care about nature. So we need to be talking to New Zealanders about what we think the future looks like, and then, you know, given the investment in us, what we can afford. So we'll absolutely be doing that.
You've had another curveball with the Chateau Tongariro, which has come back under DOC stewardship after the hotel operators closed it. Earthquake-prone building, huge, beautiful building, earthquake-prone, and they've just gone. And as you said, it's because of its history, it's on National Park, it's just become part of your asset base. What are you going to do with that?
So,
how much is it costing, by the way?
So one of the other reasons that we're doing this work that we're doing is when there is a building like that on public conservation land, it comes to us. So we've got the Chateau, we've got the Met Service building up in a reserve in Wellington, and I don't think DOC is best placed to manage buildings like that. So that is a discussion that we will be having with central agencies and ministers.
How much is it costing per week now to DOC to maintain that building that it didn't realise it was about to inherit?
So it is costing us money that's unexpected.
100 grand a week?
don't have that finger that number at my fingertip, but I think the critical...
Surely you'd remember if someone told you we're up for $100,000 a week that we weren't budgeted
so,
for.
So we're tracking what it's costing. I think the key point is it's a new thing that's come in that's putting additional pressure on an already limited baseline, and what it means is when we have to deal with that, there's money that I can't invest in saving those 4,000 species that are in trouble. And Catherine, that's the thing that keeps me awake at night, is we don't have a lot of time to really do what we need to do for nature. It's time that New Zealanders, if we want our kids to have the experiences we've had, being able to walk in forests and have the special species that we've got to get on with it. Okay. We've got to be treating biodiversity like we do climate change.
So here are the three pressures. Multiple pressures. One is the physical assets, including a random chateau that's just landed on your doorstep, although perhaps its future could have been anticipated for quite some time. You've got, are you there for preserving backcountry access, or at least assisting those groups that are passionate and will do work to maintain backcountry assets on your estate? Is the main focus the biodiversity challenge, which is endless? Is a big part of the resourcing and the spend going on being a tourism department with the Great Walks? I mean, is it reconcilable within a realistic budget?
So in terms of our visitor network, there's a whole bunch of stuff that we're fixing now. We're taking a really good look at what we think we need to have into the future. We will talk to New Zealanders about that, and organisations like the Backcountry Trust, who are passionate at helping us, are a really important part of the puzzle.
They're not the only ones, by the way. There's pest controllers up and down the country we speak to as well. There's all sorts of volunteer
groups. They're fabulous, and I love it. Every time I'm on a plane travelling somewhere, people tell me about that. So, and you know, what we see through Predator Free is when we come together and do things, we have a bigger impact. So, yes, absolutely.
And what these groups sometimes ask is, can you get some of the bureaucracy out of the way? That's one thing. And number two, can you support the resourcing of the regional offices that they work with and their ability to get decisions made through head office? They're the two things we hear. But come back to this size and scale of challenge and whether it actually is too much for one department. Are you forming a view? I mean, in your own mind, when you've done this baseline work, will you be able to reconcile all these demands within any kind of feasible budget Doc's going to get?
So I think what this work will do give us is really good evidence of how much we're being asked to do against what we've got. And then I think it will enable us to do is to have a really good discussion with ministers about the risks that they're carrying and for decisions to be made. And you asked me what I think is really important. I think biodiversity is absolutely critical. We have got things in New Zealand that are nowhere else in the world. We are losing them fast. If we don't take more action, we are not going to be the country that we all value. It's urgent.
Can I ask you a couple of things to do with budget that might save you some money straight off the top? And again, this was from our earlier interview with the very passionate Peter Wilson. Are there some inbuilt... what's the word I'm after? Inbuilt accounting measures that are just having a completely inappropriate impact on DOC. For example, the capital charge. What impact is the capital charge that Treasury is charging you having?
So the what that essentially is, and all government agencies have to follow it, is it's like a savings account. So if we know that we've got assets that are coming to the end of their life and we need to replace them, it means that we're putting money aside to
it's
do
depreciation.
That. Yeah, and if you continually raid that, you're in trouble. So we're deliberately putting money aside so that we can replace things as needed. What we can do is have a look at, does it make sense to have some huts purely as heritage? But, you know, that's not going to solve the bigger problem that we've got.
All right, Penny, thank you very much for coming in. When do you believe the baseline will be done?
So we'll have a first cut of that work done in August, and then, you know, we'll do further work from there. So really happy to come back and have another chat to you.
Please, Catherine. Do. Did you get anything in this year's budget, by the way? You got the 12.6 mil specifically for the impacts of the storms, yeah? Was there any other baseline increase?
So as you know, we've been part of this natural resource sector cluster experiment where there are three departments who got investment for 3 years in 2022. And then we're working as a cluster to prioritise what we do over time in that. So the investment that we got this year was largely to do with dealing with storm damage and also around the Molesworth station.
Hmm. The climate issue, to factor that in now, it feels belated, but I appreciate everyone perhaps in the last 2 or 3 years has had their eyes open to the immediacy. How significant do you believe it is going to be on the retention of significant significant numbers of assets? How big?
So I think it's an enormous challenge, and I think right across the country, whether it's central government, local government or business, we all need to be focusing more on it. And I also think there's a huge opportunity because we've got nature-based solutions that can help with climate change, and also the links between biodiversity and climate change is something that we're exploring really actively at the moment.
Thanks again. Penny Nelson is the Director General of the Department of Conservation.